with Don Song at UC Berkeley and Pratik Saxena, who just joined National University of Singapore. I had more caffeine than I had planned for, so if I'm going too fast, just wave your hands or something. All right, let's go. So we're talking about HTML applications and what really are these HTML applications. These are the sort of things you would think of, HTML applications being this hypermedia pages that tell you more information. But today's HTML applications are like real applications. This is an example of a 3D model editor written in HTML5, showing a model of a high-rise building. I'm still amazed they managed to do that. And so this is just really complex applications. And it's not just about complexity, but they're handling more and more sensitive and important data. This is an ad for Google Chrome. And although being a very good ad, it also makes a critical point, I think, that the Chrome browser is really at the center of your life. At least for me, my mail, my calendar, my docs, my photos are all on the cloud, and I access them through web applications. And so think about what sort of access to your data or to your life, really, an extension on the Google Chrome browser has. It's not surprising then that we have a whole laptop that runs only web applications or a phone that runs only web applications. And if you thought this is just some crazy, this is the Mozilla Boot to Gecko project. And if you thought this is just some crazy Mozilla people doing HTML5 phones, 75% of the applications on Google Play and Apple App Store are based on an HTML5 core. And not just the long tail, but Facebook's app on Android and Apple mobile devices is a HTML5 application at the core. And even Windows 8, the upcoming desktop operating system, has adopted HTML5 as a key application development platform. And so really, coming back to our original question, today's HTML applications, they are complex, massive code bases doing stuff that was really only done by binary applications before. They are privileged, access to your sensor data on my phone with cameras and accelerometers, my private documents, phone, calendars, photos. And they're not just on your browser. They are desktop applications, they're on phones, hopefully in the future in the cars and tablets. And so really the world is changing right now with HTML applications. Unfortunately, this whole thing is built on a house of cards. And we can go on a long rant about why HTML5 application security is a house of cards, but I'll just do one quick slide about it. These are two pictures of two books, JavaScript, the Definitive Guide, and JavaScript, the Good Parts on top of it. The difference in thickness should be indicative of some problem here. Web applications in general are widely vulnerable to XSS. And so my threat model for this work is really about XSS. Some attacker can somehow XSS HTML5 applications and can't really break the browser sandbox. So for example, malware that breaks the browser sandbox and starts executing on your computer is not part of my threat model. So what is the security model for all these applications? Most of them inherit the same origin policy in which all application code runs in one security principle with ambient authority. And so this one security principle is called the origin, ergo the same origin policy. And so, what is this origin? On web applications or classic web applications, it was the domain. So httpapp.com is the origin and the security principle. And so all these pages would run with this same single security principle. And this was extended to Chrome extensions. They have chrome-extension/id as their origin, and all pages run in that same security principle. Mozilla's Boot to Gecko phones have app:// as their origin. So in general, it's always the same origin policy. With the advent of sensor data and more privileges, we have seen adoption of permission systems. So this is an example of a permission system during your installation of the Google Chrome, some Google Chrome extension. Do you want to install Hello World? It can access your data on flickr.com and your browsing history, by the way. So it seems like a very powerful permission. Anyway, so that's the state of the art today. And let's talk about a particular extension that I use a lot. This is called the Awesome Screenshot extension. It's on Chrome, Google Chrome, with around 900,000 or 800,000 users. And I can go to a website, click on the button at the top right, and it will allow me to capture a screenshot. And once I capture a screenshot, it will call this function, this privilege function, chrome.tabs.captureVisibleTab. And once it calls the function, it gets a screenshot, and it will open up a new tab with an image editor in it. This image editor is written in HTML5, HTML and JavaScript. And so I can edit stuff in it and draw lines and stuff, and then click on done and save the document. This stuff is 580 kilobytes of code. And that's not surprising. They wrote an image editor in JavaScript and HTML5. And it's still running in one security principle. And so the other security primitive we had, the permission system, what is the permission for this extension? It has permission to access all my data on all my website. Not a very useful permission. And so, you know, remember that original model we had, like all application code access to ambient authority? This ambient authority in this case is access all my data on all my websites. And so going back to this picture of Chrome and my world being on the web, well, the whole world is now possibly under attack. And so 580 kilobytes of JavaScript, it's really 580 kilobytes of TCP, and that too TCP written in JavaScript. I don't know about you, but this makes me sad. You know, what can we do about this? And so when we looked at Awesome Screenshot, we noticed two problems, and these problems exist across other applications too. And so the first problem was bundling. By bundling, we mean there is just one origin or one security principle, but really two applications in this extension. So as a result, the screenshot component can save files, but doesn't really need to. Only the image editor needs access to this privilege. Or the image editor can take screenshots, but doesn't really need to. It only needs to save files. So there are really two applications that are running with the union of the privileges needed by each of them. This is not the exception. We looked at the top 20 extensions on the Chrome platform, and 19 out of the top 20 exhibited this behavior. The second problem we noticed was TCP inflation. All code runs with full privileges in this single sandbox. So really only the core application code needs to run with full privileges. And so 580 kilobytes of TCP, 500 kilobytes of that is generic libraries like jQuery, jQuery UI, and they don't really need to run with full privileges. Again, this is not the exception. We measured for the top 50 extensions the fraction of functions requiring privileges. And so we found that nearly 50% of the extensions, less than 5% of the functions require privileges. And for nearly 80% of the extensions, less than 20% of the functions require privileges. A nice 80-20 rule there. And so how can privilege separation help in this scenario? We'll go through like just a mock model and go into the nitty-gritties later. So just think about this sort of architecture. You have a privileged parent that runs with ambient authority, and you have the application code running unprivileged. Now the parent can proxy privileged calls, but enforce policies. So in this case, it can say, hey, image editor, you're not allowed to call the capture screenshot function. This simple policy immediately unbundles these two components and mitigates the bundling problem. Furthermore, only the parent runs privilege, so there's a massive TCP reduction that happens. So as I go through the nitty-gritties of how this whole thing works, I'll be using this color scheme. Black stuff will be unprivileged code, which makes me happy, and red stuff will be privileged code, which makes me sad. Black happy, red sad. Okay, so you know what is the current status of applications? You go to you click on the button while wanting to take a screenshot. The privileged screenshot component is returned. It starts running, creates a menu. You click a button. It calls the capture visible tab function. It's executed by the browser, and the value is returned. Note that everything is in red here, and that makes me really sad. So what would it work like in our proposal of privilege separation? So the user clicks the menu button. This time, the screenshot component is not returned. Just a privileged parent code is returned. And the privileged parent sees that, hey, this is supposed to be the screenshot component, so it downloads that application code and starts running it in an iframe sandbox. So what is the iframe sandbox? It's a way to cheaply create a new principle with just no privileges. You know, you can run arbitrary code in it with a data URI. And so, for example, in this line of code, I'm running the alert function completely unprivileged. All right, so you know, you have created the sandbox iframe. The screenshot component code is running in it. It creates the menu. You click the button. Now it tries to call capture visible tab. This will fail because it's running unprivileged. The browser says, hey, you're not allowed to call this privilege function. That sucks. You don't want to fail application functionality. And so we created shim code that makes this work really well. And so the way this would work is the screenshot component tries to call capture visible tab. We have shim code that sends a message to the parent saying the application wants to call capture visible tab. The parent listens to the message and calls capture visible tab, sends back the return value to the child, and the child gets the return value. The nice thing about this mechanism is this is our shim code, and the nice thing is the proxying is completely seamless. The API for the application hasn't really changed. It called capture visible tab and it got the return value. A lot of stuff happening in the background has changed, but the application doesn't even need to be aware of this change. And you can enforce policy code at the parent side based on whatever policy you want to apply. And so what would be an example policy? Well, remember our image editor example, it shouldn't be calling capture visible tab. What if it got compromised and tried to call capture visible tab? Well, it tries to do that, and you know the message is sent to the parent listens to the message, and before calling it, the policy code says, wait a minute, you are the image editor component, you're not supposed to call capture visible tab. And so it just returns denied without actually calling the privilege function. And the compromised component just gets a denied and not real screenshots. This policy code was implicitly there, but it was hidden in 580 kilobytes of JavaScript, which is not, it is not really easily analyzable. And so that's what was enabled by our design. So some of you must be calling BS on all this, right? Our policy code and our parent is again written in JavaScript. Well, there are a bunch of invariants that we are able to enforce on the parent code that makes analysis better. So the first invariant is the parent cannot convert string to code. So eval, set timeout, set interval, all these crazy functions are just disabled in the parent. This is possible because the parent is small and not running the real application code. If you try to enforce this invariant on real application code, that would just break and stop working. Second, the parent cannot execute arbitrary code from the web, so you cannot include googleapis.com or eval.com code. Third, the parent is the only entry point into the privileged origin. This is a problem if you use iframe sandbox directly. I won't go into the details of this, but this is a really important invariant too. The details are in the paper. And another key invariant is that only primitive data types, particularly strings, cross the privilege boundary. Barth and others have a very interesting paper on how if you try to send code across the privilege boundary, it can lead to subtle code injection errors. But in our case, only strings can cross the privilege boundary. And since you can't convert string to code, you have much higher assurance. So on the whole, these four invariants together allow us to provide easier analysis of the parent code, enable static audits because there's really no dynamic code, and higher assurance on the parent. So we implemented our design on a bunch of case studies. This is the table, awesome screenshot, 800,000 users, and it had 580 kilobytes of initial TCP, and we reduced it to 16.4 kilobytes. The other two case studies is what I'll go through next. If you're staring at the lines changed, know that the lines changed only counts modifications to the application code and not lines that we added, because those lines are common across all the case studies. But how many changes we had to make to the application to make it run in a new design. As you can see, the lines change is pretty low and not much work was needed. So our second case study was SourceKit. SourceKit is a text editor for your Dropbox documents, again, written in HTML5. It's a pretty nice text editor. It has syntax highlighting, in this case for Ruby. And it has a file browser like any other text editor. And it is 15 megabytes of JavaScript code. I was sad about 580 kilobytes, so 15 megabytes like really makes me cry. And it's not surprising. They've written a text editor with syntax highlighting and a file browser in HTML5. So 15 megabytes is actually, it's kind of amazing that they managed to do it. And so this 15 megabytes of code, if there's some excesses, some code injection, that directly implies possible malware on your computer, because a malicious code could just upload a malicious exe on your Dropbox folder, and Dropbox will very kindly copy it onto all your computers. So in our design, it's very simple for the parent to enforce a very strict policy saying you're only allowed to write text files like JS, CPP, C, Java, and a wide list of such extensions. It's very easy to do that. And so that enables us to provide some sort of safety with this editor running. The next case study we looked at was SQL Buddy. SQL Buddy is a database administration interface similar to, a lot of you might have looked at phpMyAdmin. This is very similar, but more Web 2.0. You log into your MySQL server, you can look at your tables and your database, and it shows you all the data. I don't know what this is. SQL Buddy, again, is a lot of code. It faces another different problem, which is the bundling problem I was talking about earlier. The typical installation of SQL Buddy or phpMyAdmin is of this form. Application.com is the real application, and SQL Buddy is installed on application.com/SQL Buddy. And so recall our original definition of origin or the security principle that all code is running in. For both of these, the security principle is application.com. There's really no isolation between this other application called SQL Buddy and the key main application.com application. So since they are not isolated, SQL Buddy could access cookies for application. It could do XML HTTP requests to the application. If the application has access to, say, my geolocation, SQL Buddy also gets access to my geolocation, which is quite unnecessary. And so when we did privilege separation, it's really easy for us, since the parent mediates all access to these privileged APIs, it's really easy for the parent to enforce, you know, the SQL Buddy code does not get access to any cookies. It can only make XML HTTP requests to /SQL Buddy/something. And so as an example, this is the policy to do this. It's just one line, a regex. I'll give you a minute to stare at it and make sure that it's correct. But the point is, it's really easy to write this policy in the parent. You just check the URL value and you're done. All right, so, and in addition, we can block geolocation or any other really privileged API. And now I'll discuss some related work before wrapping up. And so there's been a lot of related work originally on privilege separation for binary applications, QMail, OpenSSH, which is one of my favorite papers. PrivTrans was done by Brumley and Song to do automatic privilege separation, and Wedge talked about how to deal with subtle errors in privilege separation for binary applications. Those are not problems for privilege separation in HTML5 applications. But our motivation was all this previous work on binary application and privilege separation. There has been some work on browser re-architecture. Gazelle, Mashup OS, OP, Chrome extensions also kind of modify the browser security model. Our work really builds on the Mashup OS primitives that they proposed, I think, 5 years, 6 years ago. So it's really cool that the proposed primitives were adopted by current browsers, and we're able to do cool stuff with it. And finally, there have been a bunch of language techniques. IBEX proposed writing HTML applications in a high-level ML, OCaml-like language, and you know, compiling them down to JavaScript, and you could do analysis on the original code. This requires rewriting all these languages in high-level ML-like languages. That's hard and requires a lot of work. There is work on JavaScript analysis to directly analyze current JavaScript programs, but we were unable to analyze the 580 kilobytes of JavaScript code that Awesome Screenshot uses. Hopefully, there's a lot of progress being made on JavaScript analysis, and hopefully we'll be there soon. But definitely our work, in which the parent runs privileged, can definitely use these analysis techniques to audit the parent's code. Finally, there has been some work on mashup and ad isolation. We share a lot of our goals with AdJail and Treehouse. AdJail required new domains. So if in the application.com case, you would need application.com and application-sqlbuddy.com. You'd need to buy two domains, which is expensive, and most websites don't do it. Treehouse is concurrent work. They use workers, whereas we use sandboxes, but we share very similar goals. The post message work on mashup isolation showed that, by Barth et al., showed that, you know, you should really use post message, and any code crossing the privilege boundary can really impact your security. And so in conclusion, we showed that privilege separation in HTML5 applications can allow us to cheaply create an arbitrary number of components. And our approach utilizes standardized abstractions already implemented in most modern browsers. And we retrofitted a bunch of applications to demonstrate TCP reductions and some useful policies. With that, thank you for listening, and I'm happy to take questions.
All right, let's thank Dev for his talk. I think your caffeine level was right on the spot.
Thank you.
Any questions for Dev? Come on, I'm sure. All right, I have a question. Oh, please, great.
Niels Provost, Google.
Hi.
You mentioned earlier that the privileged parent gets audited or written in such a way that code injections are not possible.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate on that in some more detail?
We use content security policy to disable inline scripts. So all inline scripts are disabled, and the security policy says that scripts can only be sourced from a particular origin, the original privileged parent. That's not quite as strong, but the upcoming versions will allow us to whitelist particular scripts also. And so as a result, you can only execute scripts that have been whitelisted by the content security policy. And you can't convert strings to code using functions like eval. So code injection is basically very difficult.
And you use strict JavaScript to disable things such as eval or new function and those kind of things?
I think you can. I'm not sure about strict JavaScript. I know CSP does it. I'm not sure whether strict JavaScript disables eval.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I was curious if this works across all browsers that are reasonably modern right now, or if it's Chrome specific.
Yeah, it does.
And is this origin primitive that you're using, that you showed in the beginning for different contexts, meant for this purpose, or did you basically find a clever use for this, or? It seems like it would be a natural application, and for that.
Yeah, I think it was originally meant for mashups, but they didn't really investigate what all stuff we can do with it.
Okay.
I'm not sure what. The standards bodies. Who knows what?
Exactly. They must have had some motivation for doing this, right? Okay. Interesting. Thank you. Any other questions before we close the session? All right. Let's thank Dev again.
Thank you
for a very nice talk.